Welcome back, everyone, to 1001 Ghost, Chiller, and Lovecraft Stories. This is your host, John Hagedorn. Get ready for two great Orson Welles episodes of The Black Museum, what he terms as London's Mausoleum of Death. And now, our show.
This is Orson Welles, speaking from London. Black Museum, a repository of death. Yes, here in a grim stone structure on the Thames, which houses Scotland Yard, is a warehouse of homicide. Here, everyday objects, a silk scarf, a length of twine, a child's toy, all are touched by murder. Now, this jar, not in one of the cheap stained glass container, the type you find in a laboratory. What's in it? A colorless fluid. Water, perhaps? A cleaning spirit? No.
Acid. Well, just the thing to decompose a body without leaving any traces.
Exactly, Sergeant. You'd better take a sample of it.
Very well, Inspector. There's a jar on the shelf here. I'll use that.
Today, that jar containing the acid sample can be seen in the Black Museum.
From the annals of the Criminal Investigation Department of the London Police, we bring you the dramatic stories of the crimes recorded by the objects in Scotland Yard's Gallery of Death. The Black Museum.
And here we are in the Black Museum, Scotland Yard's Museum of Murder. Here lies death, unseen but ever present. Uncatalogued, but orderly, enveloping the shadows, papering the walls, carpeting the floor, death, for display purposes only. And here's a hypodermic syringe. It was once used to inject life-preserving serums and later used to inject poison and death. Here's an umbrella, ordinary everyday umbrella, ordinary and everyday up to a point. That is. Look closer and you'll see just how sharp that point is. Just how lethal a sword stick can be as a weapon of murder. Oh, here we are. Here's the acid jar, sealed and somber looking in its place on the shelf. Once this jar rested on another shelf, a workshop shelf in Crawley. But let's not anticipate. Let's begin our story at its beginning. Not on a shelf of a workshop in Crawley, but in the dining room of the hotel in Kensington. Dinner time. One corner of the room at a table set for two sits an attractive, fashionably dressed woman. She's joined by another equally as attractive and equally fashionably dressed.
Agnes. Oh, Remy. I'd almost given you up to last.
Sorry if I've kept you waiting, my dear. But just as I was leaving my room, I ran into Mr. Hart. He's such a lovely man. I simply couldn't resist stopping to have a few words with him.
Mr. Hart?
The nice-looking one I pointed out to you at lunchtime.
Oh, yes, of course.
He really is the sweetest thing. And so friendly.
I thought he looked rather intriguing. You must introduce us.
I will, my dear. And sooner than you think. I've asked him to join us when he comes down. You don't mind, I hope.
Oh, the contrary.
I'm so glad. I know you'll like him.
Isn't that him coming in now?
So it is. Over here, Mr. Hart.
Ah. Oh, forgive me for keeping you so long, Mrs. Regan. I had a little bother with my necktie.
Oh, please don't apologize. I only just arrived this minute myself. Oh, I'd like you to meet a very dear friend of mine, Mrs. Lansbury. Agnes, Mr. Hart.
How do you do, Mr. Hart?
Delighted, Mrs. Lansbury. I do hope I'm not intruding.
Oh, what a perfectly horrible thought. Of course you're not, Mr. Hart. Do sit down.
Oh, you're very kind.
What a thorough gentleman he was. And so amusing. So very, very amusing.
Oh, Mr. Hart, I do declare, it's a long time since I've laughed so much or enjoyed a meal so much.
Oh, save the latter compliment for the hotel cook, Mrs. Regan. And now I really must ask that you excuse me.
So soon? You won't take coffee with us?
Oh, much as I'd like to, Mrs. Regan, I'm afraid not. I have some rather pressing business to attend to this evening. Business that won't wait, even for coffee. Some other time, perhaps.
Oh, we'll hold you to that, you know.
Oh, please do, Mrs. Lansbury. Please do.
The two ladies, who were both widows, chatted on till late that evening, discussing the numerous virtues and charms of their newfound acquaintance, a topic that was continued the following morning at breakfast and then again at lunch.
Will he be dining with us this evening?
I'll ask him when he comes in.
Don't forget.
As if I could, my dear.
The amiable Mr. Hart proved only too ready to accept a second dinner invitation and a third. He appeared to enjoy the two ladies' company as much as they did his. But it was upon Mrs. Regan that he centered most of his attention.
I thought of taking a stroll in the country this afternoon, Mrs. Regan. You wouldn't care to join me, I suppose?
Why, I'd love to, Mr. Hart. I simply adore the country.
Fine. We'll start out straight after lunch.
The country stroll agreed with Mrs. Regan, as proved by the healthy flush in her cheeks that evening as she sat down to dinner with Mrs. Lansbury.
You're looking very radiant tonight, my dear.
Oh, am I?
Your afternoon jaunt with Mr. Hart appears to have brought about a most desirable effect.
It was rather refreshing.
He's not coming down this evening?
He has another business engagement.
Oh. What exactly is his business, my dear?
Well, I'm not sure. He never really discussed it with me.
Pity. Oh, by the way, I'm off to town to do some shopping tomorrow afternoon. I thought we might go together.
Oh, I'm sorry, dear, but I'm afraid I've made other arrangements.
Oh?
Yes. I promised to meet Mr. Hart. We're going to Crawley for the afternoon.
Oh, how nice for you.
You don't mind?
Oh, no, of course not. We can leave our trip to town to next week sometime. It makes no difference to me.
No, it made no difference to Agnes Lansbury. But to Renee Ashcroft Regan, it made a great deal of difference. The difference between life and death. Mrs. Regan did not appear for dinner the next evening, nor did Mr. Hart. Nothing particularly unusual about that. Obviously, they decided to stay in Crawley for dinner. Mrs. Lansbury dined alone at the hotel. The following morning, arriving down late for breakfast, she was surprised to find that there was still no sign of her friend.
Funny. Not often she misses breakfast.
Oh, good morning, Mrs. Lansbury.
Oh, Mr. Hart, good morning.
Mrs. Regan, not down yet?
No, not yet.
Not like her to be late.
Well, she probably slept in.
I wouldn't be surprised.
Have you had breakfast?
Yes, I came in earlier, just on my way out.
Business again?
That's right. Well, I must be off. No doubt I'll see you at dinner.
Yes, don't be late.
I won't. Till this evening, then.
Yes.
It was almost 9 o'clock when Mrs. Lansbury finally left the breakfast table, and still no sign of Mrs. Regan. Strange, Mr. Hart had not mentioned their visit to Crawley the previous afternoon. But perhaps the dear man preferred to keep it a secret. One never knew what sort of gossip could spread itself about a hotel, even a spark of encouragement. Still, it did seem rather odd. It seemed even more odd when Mrs. Regan did not appear for lunch. A feeling of uneasiness crept over Mrs. Lansbury. Perhaps her friend was ill. She would make some inquiries.
Oh, boy.
Yes, ma'am?
Have you seen Mrs. Regan about at all this morning?
Mrs. Regan? No, madam. Not that I can remember.
Well, perhaps you'd better take me to her room.
Very good, madam. This way.
The bellhop looked pretty in his blue uniform with a red braid and brass buttons. Such a fresh young face. So unspoiled looking and clean. With a quick, toothy smile. Not as engaging a smile as Mr. Hart's, perhaps, but nevertheless quite attractive in its way.
Here we are, madam.
Oh, thank you.
Here. Thank you, madam. Anything else you might be wanting?
Well, I'm not sure yet. Just a moment.
Must have slipped out for a bit.
Well, try the door. Locked. René? Are you in there?
Nothing wrong, is there, madam?
Well, I don't know. I think Mrs. Regan may be ill. You better go and call the manager. Tell him to bring a pass key.
Very good, madam. Won't be a jiff.
The hotel manager arrived in due course, asked a few rather pointless questions, fiddled with his large key ring, and finally opened the door to Mrs. Regan's room. It was empty.
It looks as though your flowers were groundless, Mrs. Lansbury. She must have gone into town for the day.
That still doesn't explain why she didn't come down to breakfast this morning.
Oh, perhaps she didn't feel like it. Still, I'll have a word with the room maid. She may have noticed something when she came in to tidy up.
The room maid was duly summoned and questioned. No, Mrs. Regan had not been in her room when she came in to clean up. Yes, she'd noticed something unusual, something most unusual, as a matter of fact. Mrs. Regan's bed had not been slept in on the previous night.
That settles it. Something's happened to her. I can feel it. She's met with some kind of accident and...
Pray calm yourself, Mrs. Lansbury. I'm sure there's...
Well, how can I calm myself when my closest friend has disappeared into thin air?
But, my darling...
The police must be informed at once.
Oh, come now, Mrs. Lansbury. Let's not be too hasty.
Please don't argue with me, Mr. Stewart. I want them contacted immediately.
Very well, if you insist. But I would ask you to refrain from mentioning the matter to any of the other guests, at least until we have something definite.
At the hotel manager's request, Mrs. Lansbury agreed to keep silent. But being a woman, she could not keep entirely silent. She had to confide in someone. Naturally enough, the someone she confided in was the benign Mr. James Gerald Hart. His concern was touching.
Dear me, this is most upsetting, Mrs. Lansbury. When was the last time you saw Mrs. Regan?
Just after lunch yesterday. She was on her way out.
Hmm. Did she by any chance say where she was going?
Well, Mr. Hart, as a matter of fact, yes, she did.
Oh?
Yes, she said she was going to meet you in town, that you were going down to Crawley together. Did she meet you, Mr. Hart?
Well, no, she didn't.
Oh.
That's just what I was about to tell you. I'd arranged to meet her outside the Army and Navy stores in Victoria Street at 2 o'clock. I was there on time, and I waited over an hour, but she didn't show up.
Oh.
Have the police been contacted?
Well, yes. The hotel manager, Mr. Stewart, gave them a ring shortly after lunch.
They haven't been here?
Well, not that I know of.
Hmm. You know, I rather think it might be an idea if we went round to the station and had a word with them ourselves. We may be able to give them some lead or other. What do you think?
Oh, I think it's an excellent idea, Mr. Hart. As a matter of fact, I was hoping you'd suggest it.
Good. We can go straight away. I'll get my hat and coat and join you in the lobby in 10 minutes.
And so it was that the disappearance of Mrs. Renee Ashcroft Regan was confirmed. Mr. Hart repeated his story of the proposed Crawley visit to the police. And that story was accepted. At that time, there was no reason at all why it should not have been. Well, today evidence to the contrary can be seen in the Black Museum. At least a dozen women are reported to the police as missing every week. Renee Ashcroft Regan was only one more female whose name and description had to be distributed to every station in the Metropolitan Police Force's area and printed in the current editions of the Police Gazette. Routine, nothing more. Steady, patient routine. At the Chelsea station, woman police sergeant Carol Henderson, whose duty it was to check through the daily records of missing persons in the area, came upon the case of Mrs. Regan and, as a routine step, paid a visit to the Kensington Hotel for a brief chat with those who had known her best. Naturally enough, the first name on her list was that of Mrs. Agnes Lansbury.
Now, Mrs. Lansbury, if you could just tell me when you last saw Mrs. Regan, what she was wearing, and as much as you can remember of any conversation that may have passed between you on the day of her disappearance.
Mrs. Lansbury could add nothing to what she had already told the police, but nevertheless was most helpful and directed Sergeant Henderson to the room of the much concerned but still charming
Mr. James Gerald Hart.
Do sit down, Sergeant.
Thank you, Mr. Hart, but I prefer to stand when I'm on duty.
It's not often one has the pleasure of meeting a lady policeman. But as you wish. If you don't mind, I would...
Oh, not at all. Now, I understand, Mr. Hart, from what Mrs. Lansbury tells me, that you were arranged to meet Mrs. Regan on the day of her disappearance. Hmm?
That's correct. I was to meet her at 2 o'clock outside the Army and Navy stalls in Victoria
but
Street.
But she didn't show up.
No.
How long did you wait for her, Mr. Hart?
Oh, at least an hour. Close to an hour and a half, I should imagine.
And then?
Well, as you may know, we intended going to Crawley together. Well, when I realized she wasn't coming, I drove down alone.
Oh, I see. Exactly what had you intended going to Crawley for, Mr. Hart?
Well, as a matter of fact, I have an interest in a chemical factory down there. I'm what you might call a research chemist.
Oh, yes?
Mrs. Regan was hoping to purchase some samples of certain plastic fingernails I'm manufacturing.
I see. Well, I think that's all I need from you at the present, Mr. Hart. Thank you for your time and your cooperation.
No trouble at all, Sergeant. I'm most anxious to have this matter cleared up, you understand. Mrs. Regan and I were close friends, and I hate to think that anything may have happened to her.
Quite.
If I can help you in any way, I'll only be too pleased.
That's very kind of you, Mr. Hart, but I think we'll be able to manage. If we need any further information from you, you can rest assured we'll get in touch with you.
Sergeant Henderson returned to the Chelsea police station. She had listened to what had seemed a straightforward story, but there was a doubt nagging at her. Hart's manner had been very obliging and polite, but there had been something about him she didn't like, something that didn't ring true. That something took her to the office of Divisional Inspector Russell White, to whom she expressed her doubts.
So you think it's a bit fishy, eh, Sergeant?
Well, I wouldn't go so far as to say that, sir, but, well, I do think Hart might bear checking up on.
Oh, that's good enough for me. Scotland Yard, please. Criminal Records Office.
Within the hour, the checkup had been made and the results phoned back to Chelsea. Results that stood by Sergeant Henderson's feminine intuition. According to the records, the plausible Mr. Hart had served 2 sentences for fraud.
Well, there you have it, Sergeant. It appears he's been up twice in the past 10 years.
I can't say it surprises me.
Perhaps not, but I wouldn't let it influence you too much. Just because a man has a record, it doesn't say he knows anything about Mrs. Regan's disappearance.
That's true.
I think at this stage, the best thing we can do is to forget about Hart for a while and concentrate on Mrs. Regan herself. Give the newspapers a full description of her and the clothes she was last seen wearing. The usual thing.
All right, I'll get onto it straight away.
Thus did the story of Mrs. Renee Ashcroft Regan's disappearance receive its first coverage in the London newspapers. A close-up photograph and underneath it, a full description of the missing woman as she was last seen by Mrs. Lansbury prior to her leaving the hotel for her proposed meeting with James Hart.
Mm-hmm. Ah, that should bring results, Sergeant.
Let's hope so, Inspector.
The jewelry's the thing. Mrs. Lansbury is quite sure she was wearing it when she left the hotel.
She was most emphatic about it.
Good. Every jeweler and hock store proprietor in London's been alerted. If a legitimate sale is attempted, we'll hear of it.
2 days passed. No information was received by the police. Then, on the third day, word came through that a Persian lamb coat very similar to the one worn by Mrs. Regan at the time of her disappearance had been found in a cleaner's shop near Crawley. It was later identified by Agnes Lansbury and then brought to the Chelsea police station for analysis. Laboratory tests, however, failed to uncover any further leads.
Nothing more, Inspector?
I'm afraid not. A pity it went through the wash before it was noticed.
Yes.
Still, I suppose we shouldn't complain. At least we know now, without a shadow of doubt, that something has happened to Mrs. Regan.
Oh, and also that it happened somewhere in the vicinity of Crawley, which is where she was supposed to have been going with Hart.
A further 2 days passed. Then came the information that Inspector White had been waiting for. A report was received that jewelry fitting the description issued by the police and newspapers had been offered for sale to the proprietor of a second-hand store in Horsham. It was also identified by Mrs. Lansbury as belonging to the missing Mrs. Regan. Proprietor Sally Jacobs was questioned by Inspector White.
Just how long have you been holding this jewelry, Mr. Jacobs?
1 week tomorrow. Party brought it in just after lunch.
Well, that fits. And this party gave his name as Jones, you say?
Well, here's the ticket. John Jones.
You couldn't give us a description of him, I don't suppose?
Well, so let me be remembering like he was short, stocky, with a dark hair and, well, I'm not quite sure, but I think he had a small mustache.
A small mustache. Anything else?
Well, not that I can bring to mind, no.
Yes. Well, it just so happens, Mr. Jacobs, I have a few photographs in my pocket of men who could fit the description you've given me. I wonder if you'll take a look at them.
Well, what have I to lose?
What about this one?
No.
This?
No, that's nothing like it.
How about this one?
Oh.
Well?
Oi, that's him.
You're sure of that?
As sure as I'm standing here. I never forget a fight.
Thank you, Mr. Jacobs. You've been very helpful.
Returning to the Chelsea police station, Inspector White summoned Sergeant Henderson to his office. Bringing her up to date on his visit to Horsham, he produced the photograph that had been recognized by Jacobs.
James Gerald Hart.
As he was when arrested in 1939 for fraud.
Hasn't changed much.
Fortunately for us.
Going to pull him in?
All in good time. If he's done away with Mrs. Regan, as facts seem to indicate, he must have deposited her body somewhere.
His chemical factory.
Well, that's as good a place to start looking as any. Tell Peters and Cunningham to stand by. We'll pick up Hart on the way down.
20 minutes later, Inspector White, accompanied by Sergeant Henderson, arrived at the Kensington Hotel and asked for Mr. Hart. That smiling gentleman, as smooth and suave as ever, came downstairs immediately, greeting the sergeant with an airy wave of his hand.
Good afternoon, Sergeant. I was hoping you'd call again.
Oh?
Yes, yes. I've been rather anxious to hear what progress has been made in the search for Mrs. Regan.
Perhaps you'd better ask Inspector White here that question. He's taken over the handling of the case.
Oh? How do you do, Inspector?
Mr. Hart? Before I answer your questions, Mr. Hart, I've a few I'd like you to answer for me.
By all means, fire away.
Sergeant Henderson tells me that you have an interest in a certain chemical factory at Crawley.
That's correct.
And that you arranged to take Mrs. Regan there on the afternoon of her disappearance.
Yes.
We'd rather like to look over this factory if it can be managed. Just for routine, you understand?
Of course. Any time, Inspector. Will tomorrow morning suit you?
Hardly, Mr. Hart. It'll have to be this afternoon.
Well, I'm not sure that... That would be convenient, Inspector. You see, I have a business appointment in Chelsea at 3,
then
and then...
I'm afraid your business appointment will have to wait, Mr. Hardy.
But, Inspector...
Let's be on our way, shall we? I've a car waiting outside.
For a fleeting second, the ever-present smile almost faded from the lips of James Hart. Then it broadened, and his perfect white teeth flashed in the sunlight, streaming through a lobby window.
Lead on, Inspector.
Little was said during the trip down to Crawley. In the back seat of the police car on either side of Hart, Inspector White and Sergeant Henderson interested themselves in the swiftly passing countryside, and in the front, Constable Rex Peters sat grimly at the wheel, and beside him, equally as grim-faced, sat Sergeant Dennis Cunningham. The silence appeared to amuse Mr. Hart, who chuckled audibly to himself more than once before remarking casually,
"Lovely spot, Crawley, don't you agree, Inspector?"
"Huh? Oh, yes, yes, indeed.
I've often thought how very pleasant it would be to live down here. Oh, next turning to the right, Constable."
A few minutes later, the police car came to a standstill outside the Hart Chemical Factory, which proved to be little more than a glorified workshop fitted up as a laboratory. Hart remained in the car under the watchful eyes of Peters and Cunningham while the inspector and Sergeant Henderson entered the wooden building.
Well, plenty of experimental equipment lying about.
Nothing much else, as far as I can see.
No.
Certainly no corpus delicti.
Hold on. What's in those drums over there?
Oh. Looks like some kind of oil.
Yes. Oil be hanged. It's acid.
Drums of acid in a laboratory. Nothing very odd about that unless... Unless that acid happens to contain the undissolved remains of a human body.
Acid. Just the thing to decompose a corpse without leaving any trace.
Exactly, Sergeant. But in this case, I think it may have left traces. Look, floating on the surface.
Looks like a piece of bone.
With particles of flesh still clinging to it. You'd better take a sample of the acid itself. Siphon it out.
Very well, Inspector. There's a jar on the shelf here. I'll use that.
James Gerald Hart made no attempt to deny the accusation of murder that was subsequently leveled at him. On the contrary, knowing the game was up, he admitted his guilt freely, stating that he had first shot Mrs. Regan and deprived her of her clothing and jewelry, then deposited her body in the drum of acid, a sample of which today occupies this position of honor in the Black Museum.
Orson Welles will be back with you in just a moment.
The defense, brilliantly conceived, was, of course, insanity. To strengthen this plea, Hart cheerfully claimed to have done away with no fewer than 9 other victims in a similar fashion to that in which he had disposed of Mrs. Regan. Whether or not this claim was justified will probably never be known. But it is an established fact that at the time of his trial, 5 of those he named as his victims had been missing from their homes for months. They have not been found to this day. However, justified or not, his plea was rejected and he was found guilty of murder in the first degree. His subsequent execution relieved the world of a murder student who set up in practice before taking his diploma. For James Gerald Hart was by no means an accomplished killer. The trail he left behind him bears out that fact. Rather could he be described as a dabbler in the art of dealing death, who dabbled just once too often. And now, until we meet next time in the same place, I tell you another story about the Black Museum. I remain, as always, obediently yours. Orson Welles, speaking from London. The Black Museum, a repository of death. Yes, here in the grim stone structure on the Thames, which houses Scotland Yard, is a warehouse of homicide, where everyday objects, a teapot, a sewing needle, a folding camera, all are touched by murder. Now, here's a handkerchief. A khaki handkerchief. Soldier's handkerchief. It's a common enough sort of thing during the war.
A handkerchief, Stark. Fairly clean, if a bit moldy.
That would be from exposure, Thompson. Looks like army issue.
It is, but no hero used it. You can bet on that.
Well, that handkerchief can be seen today in the Black Museum.
From the annals of the Criminal Investigation Department of the London Police, we bring you the dramatic stories of the crimes recorded by the objects in Scotland Yard's Gallery of Death, the Black Museum.
At the Black Museum in Scotland Yard. Just come into this silent room. Outside, the Thames is busy with London's river traffic, and just upstairs, police communications tap from the teletypes, ring from the telephones. But here, as I say, is silence. Now, here's a length of garden hose. Once it was connected to an exhaust of a car. From there up through the floorboards. The time was winter. The driver rode with all the windows closed, and the car crashed. The man died. It wasn't exactly an accident, no. It was murder. Here's a German Mauser, war trophy, heavy gun. It's
strange. A tiny woman held it with two hands, smudged her own fingerprints. She was found out. Her hands gave her away. The paraffin test, you know, for gunpowder smoke. Ah, here we are. Here it is, the khaki handkerchief. Originally, it was intended for camouflage. Fairly shouted for recognition at the right time in the wrong place. Yet the trouble first appeared as the commonplace ringing of a telephone.
Hello?
Mrs. Lyons?
Yes?
This is Liz Hart. How are you?
Oh, fine. And you?
All right. I'm a little worried, though. Kathy's so late getting home. Is she with Doris?
Well, they're not here. I thought Doris was with Kathy at your house.
Oh, dear. Now, where have they got to?
Oh, probably stopped at one of their friends' houses. Now, don't you worry. Kathy will come home with my Doris, and both of them will be full of stories.
So ordinary, so commonplace. One mother worries, the other doesn't. Later, around six, the worrier, Mrs. Hart, Kathy's mother, speaks to her husband.
You'll have to speak to Kathy when she gets home.
Isn't she home? It's practically dinner time. I thought she was in her room.
She's off somewhere. Oh, John, I'm so worried.
You call the places where she might be?
Hours ago. No one's seen her.
Well, we'll have to wait until 6:30. Then I suppose we'll have to start looking for her.
Oh, when will Kathy learn to let us know?
6:30. No Kathy. No word from Kathy. This time the telephone rings in the Hart household. Mrs. Lyons is calling Mrs. Hart.
Yes. I assumed you'd call me if Doris turned up with Kathy at your house. Dear, I wonder where they can have gotten to.
A frantic Mrs. Hart cradled the telephone, looks to her husband. Together they leave the house, go out into the darkening street to ring doorbells.
I'm sorry to disturb you, but I'm trying to find my girl.
But the Carters haven't seen Kathy.
Excuse us, old man, but our Kathy seems to be among the unaccounted for.
No, the Bradleys haven't seen Kathy.
Sorry to bother you. Have you seen anything of Arlo?
No. The Corbetts haven't seen Kathy.
Oh, please. I'm almost frantic. Where's my... Oh.
No one. No one has seen Kathy. No one's seen Doris. Word is getting around now. The rumor's spread. The time grows later. All of Penn, rustic Penn in Buckinghamshire, is buzzing now. At the inn, the tap room is crowded. Closing time draws near. Still, no word.
Penn Inn, landlord speaking.
Oh, this is John Hart. Look, Lyons and I are together at my place. Do you think some of the men would help us start a search?
Well, I'll ask them, Mr. Hart. I'm sure they will. Now, you stay right where you are. We'll be along very soon.
Can I have your attention, men? Your attention, men. Hart and Lyons need help. They want to start a search. Now, how many of you fellas will help? After all, neighbors are neighbors, and if we can...
So it begins. The long, hard search continues. It's 6 hours now they've been missing. It's dark, very, very little moon. The lanterns of the searchers move around the village of Penn through the fields and the clumps of trees in ever-widening circles. The men beat the fields. At the Hart home, two mothers wait. And wait. And wait.
Yes?
Nothing yet, dear. Try not to worry.
Oh, nothing yet.
The sun rides high above the fields and woods of Buckinghamshire. Sun passes its course, descending behind the hills to the west. Already the searchers, hundreds of them now, have moved outward from Penn, some 4 miles outward. The night is coming on. The doorbell rings.
Yes?
Just on my way to the inn, ma'am, for more lanterns. And just to tell you, we'll keep at it all night, if need be.
Then there's nothing yet.
Night again. Now the police are in the search, and with them a group of soldiers from a nearby camp. Steadily, monotonously, the men work, their voices subdued, the lanterns bobbing and weaving over the countryside. Outward, always outward from Penn. 5 miles now, 6 miles. As the radius lengthens, there's more ground to cover. False dawn grazes the sky to the east, and the morning star low in the west begins to pale.
Over here, mate! This way! Hello!
found something, matey?
I found something.
Yeah?
Covered up with leaves they were. Just behind me here.
Found. The weary men brought the terribly tragic news back to Penn. In the little wood with its running stream where the bodies were found, two of Scotland Yard's inspectors, Thompson and Stark, took over together. Now was the time for professionals at manhunting.
We got Stark.
Not much. Barely anything to go on. Gas mask container, wooden, out near the road. I don't think they were killed here, do you?
No, chances are against that. One of the men brought me this. A handkerchief, Stark. Fairly clean, if a bit moldy.
That would be from exposure, Thompson. Looks like army issue.
It is, but no hero used it. You can bet on that.
There are tire marks and an oil patch over to the right. Truck tires. Double rear wheels. Army truck, it looks like.
Plaster casts?
The men are making them now.
Army truck, army handkerchief. Anything else?
Not yet.
All right, let's get out of here. We've got a killer to find.
They know the routine, these two. But grimly, they set about the work. Stark takes the gas mask container, the plaster casts, the handkerchief, to the experts at the yard. Thompson stays on in Penn. He visits a different kind of yard.
Doris and Kathy were once my pupils, Inspector. I have a very personal reason for wanting to help you. But just how can I?
It doesn't need me to tell you, miss, how observant children can be. Now, it occurred to me that some of the kiddies in your school who live near the Hart's home might have noticed something unusual on their way back from school. Of course, it's only a shot in the dark, but a child might remember something that a grown-up would forget.
I see what you mean, Inspector.
Right then. Now, who in your class lives near the Harts?
Let me see now. Linda Carter. Oh, yes, and Kenneth Bradley. They're playing just over there. Come with me.
Now then, what's your name, young lady?
Linda. Linda Carter.
And yours, my lad?
Kenneth Bradley, sir.
I understand you two both live in the same street as the Harts.
Yes, sir. I live next door. Kenneth's a couple of houses down.
Right, Kenneth?
Yes, sir.
Now, I know you'd like to help me if you could. I think your teacher told you I'm from Scotland Yard.
She sure did. You don't look like a detective.
Detectives usually don't look like detectives. Now, let me tell you something. We're looking for a truck. A large, heavy truck.
An army truck, maybe?
Maybe. Why, did you see one, say, day before yesterday?
Yes, sir, at the crossroads, just standing there.
Oh, I saw it, too. It was a big one.
Oh, anyone in it?
Just the driver. He had an awful red face, and he had glasses on with silver rims. He was sitting there smoking.
Can you tell me anything about the truck?
I just remember the man in it.
It looked like a wireless truck, but it didn't have any aerial. There were those big double wheels on the back, and a number 44 on the door, and a red and blue square on one side. And the tailboard had some letters. JB, I think. And on the front bumper, there was BAT, CPM.
Battery C, prime mover. Anything else, Kenneth?
Not that I can think of, sir.
No, sir.
How old do you think the driver was, Linda?
Oh, 26.
You seem very sure. Did you ask him?
No, sir. But he looked about my father's age, and Daddy's 26. I heard him say so.
Thank you, Linda. You too, Ken. You've been very helpful. When you come to London, I'll see to it that you're shown through the yard. You'll like that, I'm sure, eh?
Inspector Thompson sought out his colleague Stark at Scotland Yard.
I've got good descriptions, the truck and the driver. How about you, old man?
Laundry mark and the handkerchief. Print on gas mask container, that's all. Anybody seen them in the truck?
A man and a woman, about a mile apart, along the line from the school towards where they were found.
Any numbers in the truck?
Battery, regiment, and division insignia.
That laundry mark's going through the mill. H2503 is being checked in every laundry in the county of Buckingham.
Good. I'll get on to Army Intelligence. We'll find that truck, the outfit that uses it, and the man who drives it. A leaky axle drips oil, does it? We'll see about that.
Well, that handkerchief can be seen today in the Black Museum. Now it was routine, except for the unforgettable sight of leaf-shrouded bodies in the wood. The mechanics of tracing a laundry mark are routine. The preservation of plaster casts of tire marks, that's routine, grim routine. With an inevitability about it, pursuing the routine, Inspector Thompson called Army Intelligence and spoke with a colonel whose main function was liaison with the civilian police.
Those are the details, Colonel.
Well, I have it all down. Large number 44, red and blue square, JB on the tailboard.
Yes.
Battery C, PM on the front bumper.
That's it.
Sounds like one of those Fordson 6x6s we've been getting for our field artillery. I'll call you back, Inspector.
Thank you.
Like war, crime detection is largely a matter of waiting for information, waiting for results when the wanted alarms are sent out, waiting for a suspect to appear at a certain place. And now Thompson and Stark waited for answers to their inquiries. In a matter of hours, the answers began to come in.
There's a report on the laundry mark, Thompson. Ties in with a series given an army outfit stationed about 5 miles outside of Penn Village.
It begins to fit, it begins to fit.
Patiently and grimly, the two men went on waiting. Once again, the telephone.
Inspector Thompson here.
Colonel Gardner, Inspector. I have your information.
Here he comes, Stark.
Good. Go ahead, Colonel.
That truck apparently belongs to the 44th Battalion Devonshire Blues. A Battery C prime mover.
Where is that outfit, sir?
They've been in camp 5 miles outside Penn Village. They've just been moved to Yoxford on the south coast for further field training.
Thank you, Colonel.
Shall I advise the CO down there to expect you?
If you would. It should take us about 2 hours.
You move fast, don't you? I'll tell him. And good hunting. Hope you get your man.
Thank you again, sir. If he's still with that outfit, we'll get him. If he's still alive, we'll get him. Yoxford, Stark. Get a car and a driver. We're going to the country.
Traffic was light and gasoline rationed England. Some 2 hours later, Thompson and Stark conferred with the major commanding the battalion.
Yes, we do have a prime mover with a leaky axle, gentlemen. As a matter of fact, it's in the shed just outside.
May we see it, Major?
Yes, of course. This way.
I have the tire cast, Stark.
Good.
And our accommodations are still a bit primitive. No proper garage facilities. We just moved into this setup day before yesterday.
We understand, Major. You've been having much trouble with that truck?
Oh, yes. A few days ago, just before we broke camp near Penn, that's over in Buckinghamshire.
Yes, we know the place.
We released the truck to the maintenance depot. Apparently, there isn't much they can do with it. The main differential is a problem. Ah, well, there we are.
JB on the tailboard.
Have a look at the inside, will you? I'll take the tires and the markings.
Check.
44 on the door, yes. Big enough. The leg could hardly miss it. Red and blue square.
Our battery shoulder patch, Inspector.
Yes, I thought so. Markings all checked. Let me see now. The tires.
Are falling in here, Thompson.
Yes, tires checked with the cast, Stark.
Well, we expected that. Here's something on the tarpaulin. What do you make of these stains?
Want a guess, old man?
Oh, your guess is as good as mine, and it'll be confirmed by pathology.
Blood. I think we're through here, Major. May we go back to your office, please?
Blood on the tarpaulin, crumpled up and tossed into a corner of the truck.
I don't think they were killed here, do you?
No, chances are against that. No blood around here.
But blood on the tarpaulin in the truck. The two detectives and the Major went back to the orderly room.
I think we'd better see the driver of that truck, Major.
Oh, yes, of course. Sergeant Carroll.
Yep.
Do you know who drives the prime mover for Battery C?
That'll be Driscoll, sir.
Oh, where is he now?
Oh,
expect he's in the battery day room, sir.
Oh, bring him over, will you? With his gear, duffel bag, the whole outfit.
Yes, sir.
A sergeant turned and left. The major with Thompson and Stark waited silently, each busy with his own thoughts.
An army is a cross-section of the population, they say. If this Driscoll did this thing, part of that cross-section, I suppose.
That blood stain. I hope there's enough for pathology to type it.
Laundry marks. His shirts and underwear ought to have the same mark as the handkerchief, if he's the man.
In the day room of Battery C, the situation was normal. The sergeant walked in without attracting too much attention.
Oh, here you are, Driscoll.
What's up, Sarge?
You are. Major wants you.
Well, what's wrong now?
He didn't tell me. Let's get over to quarters first.
Well, what for?
Major wants to see your gear. All of it.
Oh.
Let's go.
Was the waiting over? Out of the seeming anonymity of the army, had they found their man, and so quickly?
In my office, Sergeant.
Yes, sir. Oh! Colonel Driscoll, Major.
Thank you, Sergeant. Dismiss. At ease, Driscoll.
Thank you, sir.
This is Inspector Thompson and Inspector Stark, Scotland Yard. They have some questions, Driscoll. Answer them.
I'll try, sir.
Well, he's all yours, gentlemen.
May I examine your duffel bag, Driscoll?
Of course, sir.
The blouse is rather wet, isn't it?
Caught in the rain, sir.
Must have been quite a rain to go through the pockets like this.
It was, sir.
You're sure you didn't wash it yourself and pack it before it was dried?
No, sir. It was the rain, sir.
How do you explain the shirt, the cuffs cut off like this?
Came back from the laundry with the cuffs all frayed. I cut them off. I only use a shirt around the tractor.
I see. Driscoll, does this handkerchief look familiar to you?
Like any other handkerchief, Inspector?
Thompson, the laundry marks. Here, collar of the shirt.
I see it.
We'll try again, Driscoll. Look at the laundry marks on the shirt and on the handkerchief. Seems to be yours, doesn't it?
I wouldn't know about laundry marks.
They're identical, aren't they? Have you had a handkerchief like this recently?
All the army issue is the same, sir. We get a lot of trouble getting things back from the laundry. Someone else could have had this handkerchief.
Rather a careless laundry, Driscoll.
Sorry, sir. Yes, sir.
Have a look at this tarpaulin, Driscoll.
Yes, sir.
What's your guess about those stains?
Grease, sir.
That shape? That color?
Might be blood, sir.
This tarpaulin comes from your truck, Driscoll.
I never saw the stain, sir. Might be someone swapped this one for mine.
Driscoll, where were you on the 19th, 3 days ago?
Maintenance depot. Repairs. Leaky axle.
Did they repair it?
Well, they couldn't. Not in the time we had before we moved down here.
I see. Anything else, Stark?
Not at the moment.
Major, we'd appreciate it if you'd hold this man under escort. There are still a few inquiries to be made.
Yes, of course, Inspector.
Oh, Sergeant, in here, please.
There were still the loose ends on identification on the laundry problem. Driscoll wore horn-rimmed glasses. Inspector Thompson asked some more questions.
I see, Corporal. He wore army issue and suddenly he bought himself the horn frame. You joked with him about it and he didn't like it. Grew angry, did he?
Inspector Stark visited the regimental laundry depot.
No complaints from Gunner Driscoll about losing things for him. Never tore or frayed his shirts. I see. Thank you.
Stark stayed with the shirt. A battery mate of Driscoll's had noticed the missing cuffs.
The night you rolled in here, you noticed the cuffs missing. That was the night of the 20th. Very good.
Inspector Thompson turned up an interesting item.
Say that again, Sergeant.
Night we came in here, we heard about those two in the woods. We were shooting the breeze about it in the day room. All at once, sir, Driscoll looks around and says, 10 to 1, there's a murderer in here, that's what.
And once again, a telephone.
Yes? Oh, it's for you, Inspector.
Thank you, Major. Inspector Thompson speaking. He did? I see. It's been checked at criminal records. Good. Very good. Yes, of course I wanted the word at once. Thank you very much.
They found something?
The crew we left at Payne turned up the second gas mask container. Metal, this one. Had a print on it. They checked in criminal records. The fingerprint belongs to an Oscar Driscoll. Served a term 8 years ago for molesting and impairing the morals of a minor. Oscar Driscoll, you're under arrest. The charge is willful murder of Kathy Hart and Doris Lyons on the afternoon of October the 19th.
Well, that handkerchief can be seen today in the Black Museum. The defense, of course, was insanity. The defense tried to prove that Driscoll suffered from schizophrenia, split personality, that he had no recollection of what he'd done and therefore no legal responsibility. The jury brought in its verdict, and finally, this man died at the hands of the public executioner. There was apparently no doubt in the minds of the jury that this man had known and planned exactly what he'd done. At any rate, the khaki handkerchief remains in its usual place in Scotland Yard. In the Black Museum. And now, until next time, till we meet again in the same place, and I tell you another story of the Black Museum, I remain as always, obediently yours.
We hope you enjoyed these two episodes of The Black Museum with Orson Welles. If you did, please send us a review and share with friends. And you Spotify listeners, we appreciate comments as well. This is your host and storyteller, John Hagedorn. This is 1001 Ghost, Chiller, and Lovecraft Stories. Until next time, everyone, stay safe, and we'll be back soon.